last night. Tonight, they skate in San Jose against the Sharks. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, March 1st. Cloudy, maybe some light rain and a light rain-snow mix for the morning with little accumulation, if any. And then this afternoon, it changes, partly sunny and seasonal. Today's high heading for 43. Overnight, partly cloudy and seasonal, a low of 25. Tomorrow looks okay. Nothing wrong with this. Friday, sunny and a high of 43. Right now, looking at the radar, the rain is still to our south and it's moving away from us in a southeasterly direction. Wind from the north-northeast at 15, 36 degrees Racine, 37 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending most of the hour today listening to an interview from the Morning Show Archives, in which I speak with John M. Barry, the author of perhaps the definitive book about the catastrophic flu pandemic of 1918, 100 years ago, which killed millions of people. I wanted to play this interview today, not just in observance of this unhappy 100th anniversary, but also because the topic of the flu pandemic of 1918 folds in nicely to what is known as the Big Read Project, which we have talked about on the morning show. The Big Read Project involves the selection of a single book, and readers across southeastern Wisconsin are encouraged to read that book, to engage in book discussions, attend other events that touch on various elements related to the novel. This year, the Big Read has been under the auspices of the library at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and the librarians there ended up choosing as this year's Big Read book Emily St. John Mandel's best-selling dystopian novel Station 11, which imagines a world decimated by a flu pandemic even more horrific than the one from 100 years ago, a flu pandemic that wipes out most of the human race. The novel centers on a traveling group of musicians and actors who are trying to bring a bit of beauty and culture into this wasteland. It's a fascinating novel, and I very much enjoyed the opportunity to speak with Emily St. John Mandel. Ahead of playing the interview with John M. Barry about his book about the flu pandemic of 100 years ago, I thought I would play for you a brief excerpt from my interview with Ms. Mandel, in which I ask her why she chose a flu pandemic as the disaster that sets in motion the central events of her fascinating novel, Station 11.
My reason for setting so much of the novel in a post-apocalyptic world was partly just that I wanted to write about our technology. You know, I thought it would be interesting to write about our world by contemplating its absence. So I wasn't interested in writing about disaster per se, and the book moves through that period pretty quickly. But you know, if you're going to write a post-apocalyptic novel, you've got a logistical problem. You have to end the world somehow. You've got to get from point A to point B. So a pandemic just seemed like a horribly efficient way to do that. I was thinking, well, what's the catastrophe going to be? And it seemed to me that the two most efficient ways to end your fictional world in a novel would be either a nuclear holocaust or a pandemic, let's say. If you write a novel with a nuclear holocaust, you've automatically written a political novel, which just wasn't my interest with this particular work. And then given the speed at which geopolitics shift and change, you've also written a novel that's at dire risk of seeming quite dated quite quickly. A friend of mine was telling me about a book she read. I can't remember what it was called. It was an apocalyptic novel that I think came out in the 70s. where there had been a nuclear war, and the combatants were Albania and Brazil, which makes absolutely zero sense in our present day. So I didn't want to write something that would become dated in that way. So I thought, well, I'll go with a pandemic. I went with the flu, to be honest, because it's kind of relatable. You know, we've all had the flu. We kind of know what it feels like. So it's less of a leap to imagine a flu than it is to imagine, you know, some other exotic disease that one might come up with in fiction. And then, as you mentioned, there is a parallel with Shakespeare. And the Shakespeare actually followed the flu in this book. I was thinking about what the symphony's repertoire was going to be. And I originally had them performing plays from a whole range of eras. So it was William Shakespeare. It was also 20th century playwrights, people like David Mamet. And then I also actually had them performing modern teleplays. They were performing episodes of Seinfeld and How I Met Your Mother. And I just couldn't quite make it work. It just started to seem a little bit incongruous to me that these people in this post-technological world would be really riveted by, you know, plays about the New York City real estate market, you know, or these other topics that are so much a product of the present day. So I thought, well, maybe I should restrict the repertoire to earlier works, maybe works before the age of widespread electricity, just as kind of a technological demarcation point. So I started to think more about what that repertoire was going to be. And the more I read about Shakespeare's life and the world he lived in, the more I began to see those parallels that you just alluded to. One of them was just that in his time, theater was so often a matter of these small traveling companies setting out on the road. But then the other, of course, was that Elizabethan England was ravaged by repeated episodes of the bubonic plague. It just swept across the country again and again and again. And those two things were actually related. When the plague came through London, theaters would close because it was just too dangerous to have all of those people gathered together in proximity. And then the players would take off on the road for a while and go from town to town. So it seemed to me there were some interesting parallels there. And I kind of liked the idea of developing those parallels, of thinking about a world in which a small company of players might again set out, where the modern world hadn't come and gone.
Emily St. John Mandel is the author of the best-selling dystopian novel Station 11, chosen this year as the book for the Big Read Project. And now to my interview with John M. Barry, author of The Great Influenza. This is an interview which I recorded back in 2004. For the next few minutes, I'm going to be speaking with John M. Barry, the author of a book which illuminates for us a critically important moment in world history, and very much a critical moment in American history, but something that we know astonishingly little about. Or actually, that's maybe not so true. We know a lot about this moment in our history, but it is not something which is widely discussed, and it is something which we really do need to know more about. And this book is a marvelous way to learn about the great influenza epidemic of 1918. And the book by John M. Barry is called The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History. We will talk with Mr. Barry about the dimensions of this plague, its ramifications, and what we can learn from it in 2004 to make our modern world a safer place and maybe better equipped to handle such a disaster were it to befall us. John Barry has written several previous books. Probably the best known is called Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America. John M. Barry, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
If I may, right off the bat, I'd like to know what it is that draws you to things like terrible floods and horrible epidemics as a historian.
Well, a couple of things. First, I think that whether it's an individual, an institution, or a society, I think they reveal their true character in a crisis situation. Things fall away, and it's easy to see what's at the core. So I'm attracted in that sense to looking at a crisis. And in this case, I've also was very interested in the science, because this was really the first collision between modern science and epidemic disease, and science was amazingly modern in 1918. The people who stepped forward to try to confront this pandemic were just extraordinary scientists, some of the best that America's ever produced.
Tell us how you went about studying the influenza pandemic of 1918.
Well, the worst place to learn about it is newspapers, which were essentially censored, although it was self-censorship, but it struck in the middle of the war. So it basically came down to reading medical journals from the time and looking at lab notes of researchers and things like that, and some oral histories that have been collected of people who went through it.
One of the clearest indications in this book of who you are and what interests you is that you clearly have a fascination with science. You've just touched on the fact that this influenza pandemic occurred at a point in time when medical science had really advanced to a remarkable degree. Tell us something about what happened in the last quarter century of the 19th century and the early 20th century, which made such a difference, but which in the end left us still not quite adequately equipped to deal with this outbreak of influenza.
Well, medicine had been called the withered arm of science because from the time of Hippocrates into the early 1800s, it had not changed. People in the 1800s were still bleeding patients, which to us is almost inconceivable. But science did finally begin to reach into medicine in the 19th century, and first in Europe, then in the latter part of the century in the United States, in an amazingly rapid transition led by the characters in the book, American medicine also became scientific and world-class, really in a period of 15 or 20 years. In fact, William James, who was a friend of these individuals, and was, in fact his son worked for them, talked about a critical mass of genius who you bring them together and they could make the whole world vibrate and shake. And that's exactly what these people did. People like William Welsh, who was the founding dean of Johns Hopkins Medical School, or Simon Flexner, or Oswald Avery. To give you a sense of how good they were, Simon Flexner himself is a really interesting character. He was a juvenile delinquent. His father walked him through a jail to try to scare him straight. A plumber refused to take him on as an apprentice because his school principal, who had expelled him, warned him to have nothing to do with Simon Flexner. But then Flexner got a job essentially sweeping the floor in a pharmacy, and the pharmacist had a microscope. He forbade Flexner from touching it, which was the wrong thing to do with Flexner. He didn't exactly like authority. And he started playing with the microscope and became fascinated, and he ended up the first head of what is now Rockefeller University, then Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. And give you a sense of how good he was, in 1910, he got the mortality rate for meningitis down to 18%. In the 1990s, at Massachusetts General Hospital, one of the best hospitals in the world, a study found the mortality rate for the same disease 25%. Flexner was using immune serum. He was stimulating the immune system to attack the disease. Nowadays, we just rely on antibiotics. And the immune system, even in 1910, he managed to get better results than we are today. Another of the characters discovered that polio was a viral disease in 1908. In 1909, he made a vaccine that was 100% effective in protecting monkeys from polio. These were amazing scientists. Oswald Avery, as a direct result of influenza research, was the one who made what a Nobel laureate called the most significant discovery of the 20th century, and that was that DNA carried the genetic code. Watson and Crick and many other Nobel laureates in molecular biology all pay homage to Avery's discovery. So, go ahead.
The whole opening portion of your chapter is called The Warriors, and you kind of give us the background on some of these principal figures who would then, in effect, do battle with this influenza outbreak. Why did you think it was the best term to call these this array of scientists, each with their own style of working and area of expertise, the warriors?
Well, I sort of see the entire book almost structurally and conceptually like a almost a cliche war movie, in the sense that at the beginning of every war movie you watch, they show you basic training, they show you the soldiers getting ready for battle. So the first section I call the warriors because I'm explaining what went into their scientific thinking, how they had gotten ready to confront this disease. And then I go into the enemy, the virus. I talk about the virus itself, and then a section about what in effect is the battlefield, which I call the tinderbox. Because of World War One, we were really ready for, or you know, very, very vulnerable to any epidemic disease hitting because of the way the army camps were congested. These same scientists were planned in advance, anticipated that some epidemic was going to hit the army camps. And this worldwide pandemic most likely started in the United States. We can't know for absolute certain, but it's most of the evidence points to the U.S. as the point of origin, a southwest corner of Kansas, where an influenza virus, a new virus, managed to move from birds to a person and then mutated, became transmissible from person to person, and then just a draftee from that area of Kansas took it to what is now Fort Riley, and from there it spread around the world.
In an incredible fashion. Before we get into the story of this pandemic, I want to ask you one other thing, which is an interesting point you make early on in talking about the so-called warriors, some of these truly exceptional scientists who would make such a difference then in trying to deal with the outbreak of influenza. You mentioned one of them, someone by the last name of Welch, who was one of the figures who really was trying to foster a new appreciation for and attention to the whole idea of public health. I wonder if you would explain what that distinction is, because I think we kind of take the study of public health very much for granted now. In what way was that a revolutionary idea in the early 20th century, and what kind of a difference does it make in the way we practice medicine and keep people healthy?
Well, initially, the only effect even scientific medicine could have on disease was public health. For example, while they were beginning to understand the germ theory in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, they still didn't have any drugs or any way. They hadn't yet figured out how to use the immune system against it. But they did know what caused cholera. And they knew that filtering the water system, for example, would stop cholera. So, and similarly, typhoid and some other diseases that had swept through the world. So those were all public health measures that saved lives en masse, although they weren't dramatic. And the first disease, because they were prevention, so you sort of take that for granted. The first disease that they were able to actually cure was diphtheria. And in fact, the antitoxin in use today is the same antitoxin that was developed back around the turn of the last century by a couple of characters in the book, William Park and Anna Williams, who worked for New York City's Public Health Laboratory.
We should talk for the moment about what influenza itself is, whether it takes the form of this terrible influenza of 1918 or in more modest, less destructive forms. What is influenza itself, and what causes it?
Well, it is a very specific virus. Their natural home of the virus is in birds, although for thousands of years, there have been influenza viruses in mankind. And a worldwide pandemic erupts when a new virus, and this incidentally is one of the fastest mutating of all viruses. Virologists refer to it as a quasi-species or a mutant swarm, they use the term, rather than a single virus. It mutates literally a million times faster than than your average, more stable virus. So periodically, a new influenza virus will pass into mankind and adapt to man so that it passes from person to person. That's when you get pandemics. They occurred all throughout century. Even back in the 1600s, there was a worldwide pandemic that managed to cross the ocean and even infect the United States from Europe. So they're not new and they're not limited. It's not just air travel that carries the disease.
We're speaking today with John M. Barry. He is the author of The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history. Mr. Barry, one of the things that's so interesting about your book is that, I mean, obviously the story of this horrific outbreak of influenza, the deadliest plague in history, is such an interesting story in and of itself, but you are very careful to place it in proper, detailed context. So, for instance, we learn a great deal about the United States at this point in time, politically and socially and so on, and the way in which we were waging the First World War. You believe these to be important factors for us to consider in understanding how this epidemic occurred the way it did. You say at one point, for reasons entirely unrelated to the war, meaning the First World War, America at this point in time was a rumbling chaos of change and movement, its very nature and identity shifting. Tell us in the most significant way that this was true and how this relates then to the story of the influenza outbreak.
Well, it's chiefly the immigration from the 1890s until just before World War One. There were 15 to 20 million new immigrants, and that was close to, that was a huge percentage of the population, and their immediate children. The total population of the country was only 105 million. So that changed the ethnic nature of the country. It changed the religious makeup. So we had been classic WASP until Italians and Jews and Poles and Russians started coming to the country in that period. So radical, created all sorts of fault lines and pressures. And as we went to war, Wilson was very concerned. The largest single ethnic group in the country was German. Would German Americans fight Germany? Another very large ethnic group was Irish. You know, in 1916, there was the Easter Uprising in Ireland against Britain. Would Irish Americans fight on the side of Britain against Germany? And because of that, Wilson really tried to control thought. As I said, they passed a law that made it illegal to criticize the United States. They even sent a congressman to jail, a congressman, for 15 years. And they were very concerned with morale. For example, they banned playing a song titled "I Wonder Who's Kissing Her Now." And the reason was they were concerned that troops in the army camps would hear the song and it would hurt their morale because they'd worry about their wives and girlfriends back home. So this was the sort of social setting. And it had a very damaging impact on creating vulnerabilities to disease because no newspaper during the war was going to print the truth if it could be perceived as hurting morale. And all the government officials, similarly, were not going to do anything that they thought might hurt the war effort. So as influenza was coming along, they were not, William Welsh, whom you mentioned a minute ago, and who's the most powerful figure ever in the history of American medicine, as a wary colleague said, he has the power to transform a man's life with the flick of a wrist. The Army medical establishment was actually the best in the world. They incorporated the entire Rockefeller Institute into the Army. They had the best scientist in the world, Welsh, whom we just mentioned, 65 years old, 275 pounds. He joined the Army. So did all the leading scientists, or a few in the Navy. And they anticipated an epidemic hitting the camps, and they tried to stop it, but and tried to plan for it, but the Army bureaucracy, the civilian government didn't want to listen to them. They paid no attention, and it just created this explosive situation waiting for a match, and the match came in the form of the virus.
We should talk about the war effort in terms simply of the drafting of troops. Among the facts which you share with us to give us some sense of the scope of this effort to build up our fighting forces to the levels thought to be needed, that the draft age, which initially was 21 to 30, was soon expanded
To 45.
Yeah, 18
right.
to 45. That really tells us then.
And every college in the country that had more than 100 male students was not asked. They were told that they were going to have training of the students, and they essentially became military outposts. Under military command, college students were given the rank of private, and they were all told they would be going, period.
Mm. They, of course, then are crowding into Army bases literally by the millions. And one of the things you try to help us understand is the scope of this overcrowding and the way in which a public health disaster was just waiting to be happened. Just something as simple as sharing beds.
Right. Well, that would happen in the cities where, you know, all of a sudden huge factories erupted. In Philadelphia, for example, there was a marsh that in a matter of a couple of months became the largest shipyard in the world, and single plant employing 60,000 people. And people were drawn from rural areas into the cities, and not only, and they housing was so short, they literally slept in shifts. They worked in shifts, and they slept in the same bed in shifts, or they sometimes shared the same bed and slept in shifts.
So someone would get out of a bed, and another worker
would get right into it.
And breathe the same air, of course.
Exactly.
And the whole problem of epidemics of varying scopes during wartime was actually nothing new. So that's one reason why there was already this concern that something something sort of like this could perhaps happen. You talk, for instance, about our own American Civil War, in which two men died from disease for every battle-related death.
Right. Every war in American history until then, more soldiers had died of disease, including the Spanish-American War, where six soldiers died of disease for everyone killed in battle. And that was a classic case of Army stupidity, where the Surgeon General of the Army, who was a leading scientist, but he was ignored, and he warned that they were creating a very dangerous situation in a particular Army camp of 60,000 men, and unfortunately he was right, and there was a violent typhoid epidemic, which also spread to the civilian population. But throughout the history of the world, through up till then, most wars had killed more soldiers from even, not just civilians, from disease. And very often, soldiers would bring the disease back home from the front.
That makes, of course, the military establishment's stubbornness about all this all the more maddening. That
right.
There was a long history which should have compelled them to be vigilant about this possibility, and they simply chose not to be.
Unfortunately, correct, yes.
Let's talk about where this influenza outbreak seems to begin. You say that it's impossible to know absolutely for certain, but that all evidence points to a little community in Haskell County, Kansas, where some civilians succumb to a very severe influenza. And then there is some sort of base close by, Camp Funston.
Right, which is actually now Fort Riley. It's actually about 300 miles away across the state. But you can identify by name people who were drafted and who went from Haskell County, Kansas, to Fort Riley, and literally 72 hours later, Fort Riley erupted in flames. In a matter of days, you had 1,100 soldiers hospitalized, thousands more sick, who Go ahead.
And, of course, what was serious, too, is not only that outbreak right there, but the fact that you had troops streaming out of that camp to other camps across the country, presumably carrying this influenza virus with them.
Correct. And then, of course, to Europe. And there were actually three waves of the virus, of the attack. The first wave in the spring was relatively mild, much like normal influenza, and didn't attract a lot of attention. But as the virus became more and more at home in humans and more efficient at infecting humans, then several months after this first wave, then came the second lethal wave where most of the killing, I mean, it killed more people in 24 weeks than AIDS has killed in 24 years. And that basically came in September, October, November, December 1918. Then there was a third wave in 1919. And actually, 1920 was a bad influenza year as well.
Hmm. For those that suffered from this in the most serious sort of way, tell us the kind of symptoms from which they suffered and the way in which they died.
Well, the overwhelming majority of victims got an influenza attack, just as we're familiar with. You have a very uncomfortable 3 or 4 days, but a week later you're fine. But in a minority of cases, and it was not a tiny minority, it was an entirely different experience. The symptoms were so varied. They were initially misdiagnosed as dengue, which is called breakbone fever, because your joints ache that much, or cholera or typhoid. Victims could bleed from not just their mouth and nose, but terrifyingly from their eyes and ears. This was absolutely gruesome. There are, scientific reports, physician to physician, that people were turning so blue from the lack of oxygen that they could not distinguish Caucasian troops from Negro troops. It was literally an awful and a terrifying set of symptoms.
The disorder comes to be known by some as Black Plague because of some of these symptoms.
Right. I mean, rumors that with people turning that color, obviously rumors began to develop that it was Black Plague, the Black Death, which just spread, more panic. And because of the social setting, because newspapers were not saying the truth, they were just saying this is nothing to worry about, it's just normal influenza, and the public health officials kept saying the epidemic has peaked, and then the next day there'd be a new record death toll. People couldn't believe anything that they heard from any official source. They couldn't believe anything they read in the newspapers. And this was a completely alienating and isolating experience. At the same time when they're seeing these terrible symptoms, they're seeing a neighbor or a spouse die and deaths could come in less than 24 hours. And therefore, you're completely at sea. I mean, it's like if you watch a horror movie, your imagination is always worse than the monster. As soon as the monster appears in a horror movie, it's less frightening than whatever your imagination has created. And by trying to reassure people and not telling them the truth, they were actually creating more panic.
They were fanning people's imaginations.
Exactly. And it was isolating in the sense, and back then, when someone was sick on a block, the neighbors all came in, took care of them, gave them food, made sure they were okay. Not in 1918. In 1918, if there was a rumor of influenza in a house, which was many houses, no one came near it. It was totally shut off. And there was, even in cities large, Philadelphia, almost 2 million people. I had some information from a doctor there who was working in an emergency hospital and who lived 12 miles away, and he started counting the cars on his drive home. City of 2 million people, almost 12 miles distance. One day in 12 miles, he did not see another car on the road, not one. He said the life of the city has almost stopped. I mean, people were not going out.
I'm glad you mentioned Philadelphia. It's one of the cities that suffers a particularly brutal blow from this influenza outbreak. And one of the reasons was because of the actions of the politicians there, who seemed more interested in anything, in quelling any sort of panic. And they went so far as to refuse to cancel some sort of parade for selling war bonds.
There was a Liberty Loan parade to raise money, and this was just as influenza was beginning to hit. So the health officials actually knew what was coming, but it was before it struck, so the average citizen was not paying any attention to it. At that point, there were literally only in the tens of people sick, not hundreds of them. But there was this great rally to raise money for the war that would have hundreds of thousands of people in close quarters on the street, and physicians who knew what was going on were begging the city to cancel the parade. But the city didn't do it, and 72 hours after the parade, there were hundreds dying a day, essentially. And Philadelphia became one of the worst hit cities. No exaggeration, literally you would have priests driving horse-drawn carts down streets calling upon people to bring out their dead. It really was like the Middle Ages there. They ended up using steam shovels to dig mass, you know, deep trenches for mass graves, and they just rolled bodies into these mass graves without coffins.
This is as good a time as any to mention the fact that not only were there these instances in which city governments were woefully ill-prepared and insensitive to the severity of what was occurring, but also from the national government, so keenly focused on the war effort, almost not a word was spoken about this influenza outbreak, and absolutely no word at all ever spoken by President Woodrow Wilson.
That's
any
correct.
Sort of public statement of concern
of any,
about influenza.
None of any kind. All he cared about was the war.
I want us to take a moment to talk about a particularly serious outbreak which occurred not too far from where I'm speaking to you, just outside of Rockford, Illinois.
Oh, sure, Camp Grant.
Camp Grant. And not only was there a very serious outbreak of influenza there, but you tell a terrible story about a train load of troops traveling from Camp Grant into the South, I believe.
Right.
Tell us about that experience.
Well, Camp Grant had one of the best medical staffs of any camp. In fact, they had experimented using masks early in 1918 on other respiratory diseases, and the masks, of course, like surgical masks, became sort of a trademark of the epidemic. All the photos show that. And the medical staff there was insistent that this overcrowding was going to be very dangerous, and the camp commandant simply overruled them. And a couple of things happened. Number one, on the day that the 500th soldier died at Camp Grant, the commandant took responsibility, I guess, for overruling his medical team and shot himself. But prior to that, he had let a train load of several thousand troops be transferred to a base in Georgia. And this train ride was, it was like cattle cars filled with a slaughterhouse. By the time the train arrived in Georgia, there were already hundreds dead. And, yeah, I mean, you can imagine the close quarters of a packed troop train. They weren't exactly conveniences for the soldiers. And again, these horrific symptoms, blood, people slipping on blood on the floor and terrified and leaning out windows and trying to escape whenever they stop for a moment with officers, you know, ordering them back into the train. And probably at least 10%, possibly more than that, of all the soldiers on that train died. And, of course, they also took the virus to the new camp.
You mentioned at one point that everywhere, as in Philadelphia, two problems developed: caring for the sick and maintaining some kind of order. in those cities that were particularly hard hit by influenza. First of all, we should mention the fact that there were simply not enough doctors, not enough nurses, not nearly enough to contend with this crisis.
Right, no plan to allocate the resources that they did have. And most of the governments broke down, I mean, with the exception of San Francisco, which may have been because they had gone through the earthquake not much more than 10 years before. San Francisco was about certainly the only major city in the country whose newspapers told the truth, whose public health officials tried to plan in advance. They let people know what was going to be happening before it happened. Resources were allocated. The city divided into districts, and you know, San Francisco still suffered from the influenza, but the panic didn't seem to hit San Francisco as it did elsewhere.
There, of course, in great cities would be cancellation of all church services,
right,
of all public gatherings, and
right,
so on.
At the same time, they're saying, this is only influenza, don't worry about it, fear kills more people than the disease. At the same time, they're closing, as you say, churches, schools, saloons, movie theaters, no public gatherings allowed. So, I mean, this obvious disconnect just reinforced the fact that the public authorities were lying when they said there was nothing to worry about.
Give us some sense of how some of these issues played out as this pandemic crossed the globe. I mean, was there this same sort of predilection for the cover-up in other places around the world, or was this a somewhat unique experience here in America?
Well, the name of the disease, came to be called Spanish flu, Spanish influenza. And that's indicative of the same kind of thing happening elsewhere. And the reason it's called Spanish influenza, and while it's possible it may have begun somewhere other than Kansas, one thing we do know is it did not begin in Spain. Spain was not at war, so they didn't censor the press. So when the epidemic hit Spain, it was all over the newspapers. And the king also got sick, although he recovered, it got even more publicity, and it became known as the Spanish flu. But elsewhere around the world, or at least certainly in the West, they treated it as they did in the United States. They told lies. Even in France, doctors continued to diagnose what was clearly influenza as other things, cholera and typhoid, for reasons that are not quite known unless it was morale purposes.
We should mention something else that made this a particularly frightening disease, and that is the fact that those who died from it...
Right, the young adults.
Yes, yeah, tended to be young, otherwise healthy young adults, whereas so often with other diseases or illnesses, it will be children and the elderly and others who already have health problems that might be more apt to succumb. But somehow in this influenza outbreak, it seemed at least that younger and healthier you were, the more likely you were going to be to die.
Right, and the irony is that the immune system changes with age, and it's strongest in young adults and weaker as you get older. And what was happening was that as this virus invaded the lungs, in young adults, the immune systems, although they couldn't recognize a specific virus and couldn't mount a specific attack against it, the immune systems were mobilizing everything they had against it. And the immune systems were actually killing the young adults. It was like the army officer in Vietnam who said we had to destroy the village to save it. The immune system has many lethal toxins. Toxic shock syndrome, for example, is an immune system disease, and it was unleashing these lethal toxins in the lung. And the autopsies were being compared. The only other lungs that physicians, pathologists had seen that compared with this was soldiers who died of poison gas. So, go ahead.
We should return to the warriors with which you begin the book, the warriors that combated this terrible influenza. and just speak at least briefly, I'm afraid, about their efforts to try to stem this terrible tide. One of the things that is, of course, interesting in your book is that you really take us into the midst of the experience of those who do this kind of work, and in particular, the awful balancing act between this sense of urgency, the need for haste, for something to be done as quickly as possible, and yet the fact that this had to be done with painstaking attention to detail. And you said that even a lot of this work was actually very tedious work, but that's the way it had to be.
Right, and you could not speed up the length of time it took to grow a culture in the laboratory. In the meantime, your colleagues and your family are subjected to this disease. And yet the scientists, I mean, they did not know the cause of the disease. They had already succeeded in many diseases in developing immune serums and vaccines. So if they could figure out what caused this disease, they had a decent chance of developing something that could stop it. And in fact, in a few instances, they did develop some things that probably worked pretty decently. They certainly could stop some of the secondary bacterial infections. I mean, people died from two things. Number one, the virus directly and the immune system's attack on the virus. Those people would die very rapidly. But sometimes, in more than half the cases, actually, people would seem to recover, and then a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, a secondary bacterial infection would cause pneumonia, and they would die of that. And even without antibiotics, they managed to develop some therapies for some of the pneumonias that were quite effective. But part of the frustration was the inability to produce these things in mass quantities and get them out there, distribute them under the time pressure that they were facing because the disease moved so rapidly. But then they kept looking for this, of course, after the pandemic ended. This, of course, was the medical mystery of the early part of the 20th century. It was like cancer and heart disease, diabetes combined. It was the most important problem. And, you know, again, they stayed after it. Oswald Avery was looking for ways to cure pneumonia. People were dying of pneumonia, even though they weren't quite certain of the cause. And he focused on the pneumococcus. And he was sort of an inspiration, really, to me during the course of the work. He would have failure after failure after failure after failure. He said, failure is my daily bread. I thrive on it. He said, whenever you fall, pick up something. And ultimately, his understanding of the pneumococcus is what led to the discovery 25 years after the epidemic of DNA is carrying the genetic code. So there, in the end, you know, there was this tremendous scientific achievement, and there were lesser ones as well.
Let's talk about the final scope of this pandemic. It's of course impossible to know, but what kind of numbers are we talking about?
Well, if you generally read the press, they'll say more than 20 million people. That's actually an estimate made at the time, and it's been revised many times since then. Every revision has been upward. That was fairly accurate, reasonably accurate for the West, but vastly understated the rest of the world. And a Nobel laureate, McFarlane Burnett, estimated that the worldwide death toll was at least 50 million and could have been 100 million. And that's in a world with a population less than a third what it is today. So if you adjust for population, you're talking about 175 to 325 million. And his work is, I mean, some fairly recent epidemiological work has also reached the same conclusion that he did earlier.
John M. Barry and his fascinating book, widely regarded as the definitive account of this disastrous flu pandemic, is titled The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the deadliest plague in history.
Making waves live in Milwaukee.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I'll be speaking with the author of a brand new full-length biography about Laura Ingalls Wilder, one of history's most